and welcome to another edition of Turn Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, not one, but two DC hardcore legends from the band Scream, from the band Wool, Pete and Franz Stahl are here, and oh my gosh, am I excited for you to hear this. There's a brand new Scream record that is fantastic called DC Special, but we go into a lot of stuff. This is a good one. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by and answered by my brother, Tristan Abraham. He is the show producer and guest booker extraordinaire for this podcast, and he will get the message to me. He also runs a Facebook page as well as a Instagram page for this podcast. Both of those can be found at Turned Out of Punk, as well as a YouTube page and a TikTok page that can all be found at Turned Out of Punk. To find me, I'm on Twitter or I guess that's called X, and Instagram at Left4Damian. And that is that. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about it. Let everyone know there's this podcast, and each and every week we have cool guests on it that talk about punk music. I play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. We are off tour now. I'm home for a bit before we go on tour in the new year with the band Superchunk. You can check out past episodes for members of Superchunk on this podcast, and I'm very excited about this tour. Oh my gosh. More information can be found at fuckedup.cc. We got some new records over there and the like, and so check out the band. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, on today's show, from the band Scream, Pete and Franz Stahl, as I tell them on this episode you're about to hear, huge band for me, and my gosh, this has got a lot of excitement in this episode. I'm very stoked for you all to hear it in 1 second. As I said also off the top, there's a brand new Scream record called DC Special, available over on the venerable Discord Records. And it's got contributions from Ian MacKaye and Dave Grohl's on it as well. Also, it is sadly the last appearance on some of the tracks by original Scream drummer, Kent Stax, who sadly passed away just prior to this interview taking place. So rest in peace, Kent, and pick up this record. It's fantastic, as I said. And that's the thing about these Discord bands. They are lifers. And you can talk about Hammered Halls. You can talk about Scream. You can talk about the new Fugazi spinoff projects that are coming out, the new Soul Side. A lot of classic stuff is still coming out of this little crew of people. And it's ultimately kind of a little crew of people, as we'll talk about on this episode. I could go on for days about this episode before you hear it, but I'm not. I'm going to show some restraint and hold myself back. That's it. Okay, sit back, relax, and enjoy Pete and Franz Stahl on Turned Out of Punk. Franz and Pete, thank you so much for coming on Turned Out of Punk.
All right.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
Well, this is a huge thrill for me because we've got some weird connections that I hopefully will come up over the course of this podcast. But outside of that, still Screaming, one of the greatest albums ever written, and a record that's really responsible. All your records, obviously, and we're going to talk about as it changes. But that record for me was like a real jumping on point for DC hardcore when I finally got to hear it.
Oh, thank you. It's like 40 years old. It came out January 1983. We recorded it in 82. I think there's 21 songs on it. Took 3 days. We recorded and mixed it in and out. Don't remember much from the session because it was that quick and a blur and like a really exciting experience for us at the time. We were so much younger. But that's what's so, fun about this new record we have, DC Special, because we ended up recording back at the same place that we started out at. And in fact, we did our first demo at that studio before we even hooked up with Discord.
Well, I was going to ask, is that demo is done before the Jerry Williams demo? Because the Jerry Williams demo is done right around the same time as the Still Screaming sessions, right?
Yeah, the demo I'm speaking about is four songs. We did this with this guy, Jefferson Rogers, who was in this band called The Distractors. And I was going to, I was a bit older than my brother and Skeeter Enoch Thompson. He goes by Enoch these days, so that's what I'll be saying Enoch in the interview. And Kent, I was going to clubs and seeing new wave bands, and also some, was going into the town, saw Bad Brains, and we were kind of just learning about the new wave and punk scene. And I was sharing that with my brothers by I would just call them up from the club and hold the receiver in the air so they could hear these bands I was checking out. These great DC bands like the Raz and the Deceits and Slicky Boys. Those are like the kind of the three main ones. And then there's like a huge rockabilly scene that also is part of the punk scene in a way. Yeah, so that's kind of we I met Jefferson through that experience, and then he brought us to Inner Ear, introduced us to Don, and recorded our first demo, which was probably like, it could be as early as 1980, or 81. Well, probably more likely 81. And we did Ultraviolence on that, Still Screaming, and a couple others, Solidarity. So it had to have been after, that political movement had begun. So yeah, that I don't know. It was definitely before the Jerry Williams.
Well, I want to get to all this stuff, but I guess this leads in perfectly. So I imagine being the older sibling, you got into punk first. How did you get into punk, Pete? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, our father managed rock bands in the mid 60s, so we got exposed to a lot of early garage punk in a way, even though it was on AM radio. But I consider some of the early like Seeds or the Electric Prunes, Music Machine, all that stuff kind of punky,
Absolutely.
the way they looked, they were different. And so we, I remember my dad hooked up with this DJ in Washington, D.C. called Cousin Duffy, who was a DJ, I think, on WPGC, because AM radio was what was ruling then. This is before FM radio, which was another educator for us later on. But when we were like, I was t 10, 9, Franz like 6 or 7, we were listening to these records and getting our first singles and stuff. I was getting my first singles. And, so that was my first introduction to punk, and then actually through radio later on, the first time I heard Iggy Pop was on the Mystic Eye radio show. So,
That's awesome. So, like, would there have been kind of proto-punk stuff happening in sort of the DC area around that time in Virginia?
well, yeah, man. I mean, I wasn't going. It was all new to me. I kind of learned a lot about it through radio, really, through some of these local radio shows in DC. There were bands I didn't even get to see, like a band called White Boy. I never saw the Penetrators play. Some really cool bands that were very important that you can find some on. There's a compilation that Limp Records put out, 30 Seconds Over DC. I highly recommend it because one of the best punk songs out of DC ever came out of DC was The Break by the Penetrators. Just go, you can find it online now. But yeah, that's a fucking killer song.
Yeah, I love that early Limp Records DC scene. And I think one of the issues with the way punk history gets taken up is obviously the scene that you guys are a part of is just so monumental that it tends to eclipse everything that kind of came before it. But there's all that fantastic kind of new wavy, artier punk stuff, and then like White Boy, whatever the hell that was.
Yeah, I think that, well, I'm sure you've interviewed Ian, and he's like the archivist of our neighborhood we come from. So he's got the names, and he knows where everything's where all the bodies are buried, But I mean that new wave, arty, avant-garde, like scene that was in downtown in the Arts District, this couple block radius, it was certainly permeating out both sides of the river, and we were starting to become aware of it and getting into that shit, and that's why we wanted to kind of fuck shit up in our neighborhood and start a band.
Franz, what did you make of your brother getting into this stuff? Because a lot of times when siblings come on this show, the younger sibling talks about it being kind of like freaky, especially because punk had such a bad media reputation around that.
Well, I mean, if it's your brother, I mean, you always look up to your brother. And I was younger, so I couldn't get into any of these clubs to see these bands. And so my introduction to it all was what we listened to on radio, as Pete explained, and what, whatever records we
And
got.
also what I mean, initially I wasn't at that time I wasn't really playing music. They Franz and Enoch and Kent asked me to sing for the band that they were putting together. But those guys were actually playing music. I was just fucking going to clubs and,
Yeah.
hanging out.
I mean, it wasn't until we started going to Madame's Organ, which obviously was a club, not a club,
The
that I
art
could go
gallery.
in and see an art gallery, that I could see bands play. And I didn't really know what to make of it, except for seeing the Bad Brains and that changing everybody's world. And you knew right then what you wanted to do. But I remember, like, one of the first punk rock records I bought, oddly enough, was The Jam. And it wasn't a punk rock band at all. I just saw the cover, and to me, I thought that was punk rock. So I bought it. And of course, I loved it. And I still love The Jam to this day. But yeah, my introduction before I could go to clubs was the radio and whatever my brother brought home, and played on the stereo.
It's, I find
Of
it
course, if
interesting.
he caught me,
Sorry, go on.
I was, of course, if he caught me playing the stereo,
I was going to say the Jam are a band that come up on the show, like Billy Bragg, Colin from Cox Bar brought them up too, as being the punk band that they were like, okay, I get this now, because they were kind of not a punk band at the same time that they were a punk band. They dressed differently and they had a different approach to songwriting, but there was. I think it made punk a lot bigger tent when they showed up.
I mean, all that
Yeah.
British music had a huge influence, on us. And yeah, man, I mean, that's what punk is not conforming to the norm and just being different, whatever, in your own neighborhood. Like I said, all the bands that were playing in our neighborhood were playing Lynyrd Skynyrd, and so we just kind of wanted to stir things up a little bit and be different, feeding off the energy and the shit that we were seeing around us and the bands that we were getting turned on to. So I mean, all that UK punk scene was so diverse, I mean, the Stranglers to the Jam to the Sex Pistols to Sham 69. I mean, those are just the big ones, but there was also so many different kinds of bands all doing their own thing.
And also, it was like, I mean,
I mean,
when
when
we went down,
go ahead, I'm sorry. No, go
I
ahead.
just said
Sorry.
also when it was like one of the reasons why we got so into the punk scene was that we would go see these bands. And like when you think of bands like Lynyrd Skynyrd and these other bands, it just seems like an achievement you'll never make, or it's just so far away from you, in terms of playing and whatnot, even if you like the music, and seeing the punk bands was like, wow, those guys, they look just like us. They're just our age, the same
That's
age.
true.
It's like
That's
we,
like yeah, like
it
seeing
really
like
gave us it gave us confidence to like, hey, well, we can write our own shit and do our, and actually get shows, or hopefully do shows. Whereas stadium bands and everything else that was going on, it just seemed like so out of reach.
that's a
It
good,
was a
very good point as far as our development as musicians, because that's one reason. I mean, I had been playing guitar when I was 14 or 15, but because I and Franz got into music so young, going to shows at 10 years old. By the time I was 15, I was listening to fucking Larry Coryell and Mahavishnu and all this jazz fusion. And I went through a whole Southern rock period. I mean, I love Lynyrd Skynyrd too, especially the early records. But I never thought I could play that stuff. And it wasn't until I started seeing some of these new wave bands at the clubs in town. We're seeing the Teen Idols at Madame's Organ, and that look like they're our age, and I can do that. I think that's a common, I think that's a, not a, I think that's a kind of a common theme for people starting out. They see something, experience something that they've had in them, but they never thought they could do it. And then they see something and they, I can do that too,
I think that's the best thing about this genre is that's where it's kind of like folk music, where the message and what you have to say is more important than your ability to say it. And you can let that ability come once you start saying it and develop it. And it just gave so many, and to this day, gives so many kids permission to fail and make bad art in the attempt to try and find themselves.
Mm-hmm. It's a good way of
absolutely.
I find it also interesting, Madam's Organ, you know, being, like you said, an art gallery more than it is a venue, but it's like a yippie. It was like a yippie thing, right?
It was. And that's, I don't know how unique that is to that scene, New Wave and punk, coming out of the counterculture era, you know, that what happened in the 50s with, you know, beat poetry and into the 60s and the reaction to the wars and the civil rights movement. So those counterculture movements certainly gave a home. And maybe, you know, like, in there might have even been like, wow, look at this energy happening. Let's like re-energize our movement to get these kids in there. But, you know, also I think because of the nature of Washington, D.C. being the home to, it's the capital of the United States, and it's such a government, you know, that is our industry, you know.
Yeah.
Growing up then, not so much now. I mean, it's still now, of course, but back then DC was a much smaller area. There was no huge tech industry that's in Virginia and things like that, and it was just everyone worked for the government or related kind of things. So you were kind of permeated by politics. It was a conversation. Our parents were into politics and involved with the Democratic Party. And, you know, so, I mean, I think if you look at like the Detroit early scene with the MC5 and, you know, those bands, they kind of, there was, it was kind of also coming out of that 60s counterculture that was universities and, you know, across America.
Yeah. I find it, you know, fascinating with, just to go back to the yippie thing, like, you know, Ken Lester, who managed DOA, was a yippie. And, you know, you have David Peel in New York, who was a yippie. So like you're saying, there is this sort of like holdover from the 60s of people that are giving space in some cases, like you're saying, maybe trying to repopulate their ranks. But at the same time,
well, like, you know, like in D.C., especially because, you know, that we had the Rock Against Reagan shows that were on the Mall, and these were all kind of annual events that had kind of, that the yippies and Normal and those organizations kind of, they knew how to get those permits and create these opportunities to have you know, alternative voices and kind of push for new ideas and also to like shout back at what was going on, you know, in the halls of Congress and shit like that, you know?
I can, you know, it's funny because I'm reading this book right now called Fire and Rain. It's about Nixon and Kissinger during the war, the Vietnam War, and mentioning Madam's Organ and what it was, the yippies before. I could totally see it now reading this book about how these student activists would come in and organize all these anti-war protests and all this stuff. And I'm sure it went through Madam's Organ at some point when it was the yippies and whoever was a part of it prior to that. I could just read into that from that book.
You know, it's Tristan, right?
No, that's my brother. I'm Damien.
Damien.
Why did I...
Well, my brother's the show booker, but I'm the okay. I'm a lead singer in a band, so I have lead singer brain. No offense, but so no,
I got the same molecules floating around.
No, you know,
in my bald head. You know, we met once somewhere, like, you know, I do a lot of tour management. We met like on an airport shuttle one time.
We did. And I wanted to punish the shit out of you. I was like, it takes a lot of restraint. That's why I started this podcast, because it's the only way to socially acceptably ask these sorts of questions of someone.
Yeah. Okay, Damien, sorry. Please don't call me Franz.
No, do not worry. I you know, I think all us siblings can. I call my kids the wrong. I was singing happy birthday to my youngest child and called him my middle child's name at his birthday party the other day, in the ultimate moment of embarrassment and humiliation as a father.
I was going to add, you know, we were one of the first bands to go over to Europe and play from the hardcore scene. And there was That and one reason why it was really easy for us, because none of the promoters were going to be booking hardcore bands in the UK or in Europe, but there was still this network of squats and community kind of buildings that were in some cases had support from the social democratic kind of left-leaning governments, but they were also kind of left over from that counterculture movement that came out of the 60s. And so that, and you know, these were places that provided a space for people to create, whether it be music, theater, or art, and kind of self-funded DIY places. And lots of cases, different types of politics, communists, and so forth. But they were, there was a network that we could plug into and play in Germany and play in Holland and play in Italy and play in Spain. So, we were all kind of, I think it's just a continuation of those kind of movements is kind of giving a space for a new movement to come through, be themselves.
Absolutely. It makes complete sense too, because like Ken Lester being the guy who taught DOA, or like, DOA with that famous book that they gave to Black Flag, which then becomes the framework for this entire community to this day.
Right. I forgot about that.
But you're right, it really is transposed on top of this sort of like radical network and this idea of sharing numbers and communicating with people outside of sort of the traditional structures of that you're supposed to do things. And you're right, it's 100% kind of built on top of that in a way.
For sure.
It's also interesting, DC, like being a DC being such a political town, how it is really the first American political punk scene where like it's about being a punk.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like there's ethics to it that are specific to punk.
Well, and I, at least with our band, I mean, I guess I was a little bit older than, I'm a couple of years older than Franz and Enoch, and I'd already been traveled outside the area a little bit, because that's certainly what informed our world politics was when we started going to Europe too. But yeah, when you grow up in DC, you're immersed in that, and it's part of your consciousness. And then you, if you want to like speak to what you see around you and what you feel inside, then that's, then it's, that's a political act in a way. And so just that's what, we did through our, or we know what the lyrics that we wrote. So I'm glad that we maybe, kind of help lead that way in our little tiny scene. We were the first band to put an album out on Discord, so we're the ones that had the most songs at the time, So, a lot of the younger, a lot of the bands are that we were kind of into and are part of that Discord scene. It's such a small scene. They were like kind of creating and exploding, going away to school, and we stuck together. So, but yeah, I hope I answered your question. Or
You did, and also I think you brought up another point, which is like you're the band that tries to keep that flame alive. There's a lot of people that come on the show, be it people from Dinosaur Jr., be it people from all sorts of bands that were part of that sort of first wave of American hardcore, that by around 84, they're like, well, the party's over. Like this is getting too violent. This is getting too hairy, and move on to completely new genres in some cases. But you guys seem to be a band that tried to stay punk and tried to find a way to stay punk in a world that was kind of changing around you, it seems.
Well, yeah, I mean, we love we love being together and playing music together and getting into stuff and going on adventures, I mean, our little and it's like it's I never we've never gone through anything where we lost our brother Kent like a couple weeks ago. I mean, he'd been sick for a long time, but by talking about him and by playing the songs that we create with him, we keep him alive within us. So and I think we also kind of keep alive our where we came from, and that's in some ways, say like, you never grew up, man. Well, that's okay. I'm I'm really quite happy to like still kind of feel the same way, and you know, so I don't know, Franz, what do you think? I mean,
Well,
I think we, you know, all of us were like way into music, not just punk. So we wanted to be musicians and working band and be a working band and make a living at it if we could. And we never really fully accomplished that, but we definitely made a bunch of records and made, made our point.
I will say, in a weird way, through my brother's lyrics, lyrically, I mean, we were actually, in a way, far more political than the DC bands, because they were more, it was like what they used to call personal politics, where he started talking about things on more of a global scale. And I don't think DC was ever like that. It was, and you know, we were given license to that through hearing what the Clash was saying, and even, you know, to what the Sex Pistols are saying, you know, this is what the fucked up shit that's going on. And to this day, Pete lyrically still writes about stuff like that. And I don't really recall a lot of the DC punk bands being so particular in their political stance. It was always more of a personal thing, personal politics and the scene, and stuff like that. And I think it's inherent in my brother, just because we grew up around a father who was, you know, part of the 60s, and, you know, speaking out against this and that. I think it comes from that more than the, you know, and the fact that we're in DC and we're constantly bombarded by it in the news. And it's still to this day the way my brother expresses his himself and his world views.
Yeah, but like I also think all the bands that, whether personal politics or whatever you sing about, but the bands that are being, pushing the envelope and being different, making noise and get, and within this community that we're a part of, it also gives, voice to everybody that comes to see you. And so, and it's your community. And then, and that's, I think that's a political act too, by screaming like that and giving other people an opportunity to scream back.
Not so much lyrically, but I find it interesting. Daryl Jennifer brought it up when he was on the show, like the different sort of philosophical approaches between, you know, Ian, I guess broadly speaking, but Minor Threat and versus Bad Brains, where it's like local versus global, where the Bad Brains, Daryl talked about how they had to leave DC to try and get their message out there. And Ian obviously very much builds this thing and is, you know, Minor Threat and everyone in DC. You guys seem to be halfway between these two worlds, where you're clearly part of this DC thing, this DC hardcore brand, but also at the same time, you are a band that's touring Europe, that you're going across America. You're playing in New York so much at a certain point. Like, you seem very much in line with the Bad Brains as much as
Yeah,
what's happening in DC.
absolutely. That's what
That's
I was
because
saying.
they
We wanted to
need.
be working. We wanted to be a working band and get our music out there. And the Bad Brains gave us that opportunity. They really gave us our first real show in DC as far as within the punk scene at the Wilson Center. And then we also traveled together in my van up to New York to play CBGB. And they brought us up there. So they were hugely instrumental in getting us going. And I think that I mean, other DC bands finally, when they had the opportunity to start touring, and obviously Fugazi did too, Minor Threat did as well. Teen Idols were one of the they went all the way to California early on. But yeah, I think Bad Brains and us, we really were wanted to be a working bands, which might have been a little bit more of a different focus for some of the other bands coming out of our scene, for sure.
You bring that Teen Idols tour, and I just rewatched American Hardcore. They did a screening of American Hardcore at a theater here. And there's that part where Henry talks about that tour, and he's obviously rooting for the Teen Idols. And when they went to the West Coast and they saw how the kids on the West Coast were doing it, and this sort of the rise of this hardcore invasion that happens in LA punk, which, depending on which side you fall on, is the worst thing to ever happen or the greatest thing to ever happen. But they seem to come back Well, Henry says we brought that back when we came back to DC, and we kind of like we're like, here's how we're going to do things now. Do you remember that happening? You know, because knowing Teen Idols before that, and then seeing, was there a shift that you guys perceived happening at that time?
I don't know. I don't really. I didn't. Wasn't conscious of it. Because the first time we went out to California and we played at the Olympic Auditorium and it was like 4,000 kids. Like we're like, holy shit! Isn't that we had
Yeah,
nothing like that where we're from. So I can understand it that those guys when they went out there they were probably just as blown away as we were whenever it was like a year or two later. But I mean, I can't. Maybe, there was more of a pit after they came back. I don't know, but
because I think it's in Dance of Days, even some of the limp bands talk about how like the scene changed and all these hardcore kids came in and kind of, you know, once again, this sort of echoing of what's gets said in LA, like they ruined our scene. And it always seems like
oh
the younger generation is going to ruin the older
it
generation's
says
scene.
damn kids from the suburbs.
Yeah. Well,
Says the kids that were originally from the suburbs that moved there 5 years earlier.
I mean
You
that's a
know?
good thing, and I think it's a good thing. But like, I want right now the hardcore scene across America is kind of exploding and re-energizing, and there's all these killer bands out there. Half of them I'm not even aware of. But then, you can see them at their, at the shows, and the pit sometimes seems even more extreme than it was when we were kids. And I'm like, kind of like, wow, that's really violent. But they all seem to be into it, So yeah, that's what's supposed to
Yeah.
happen.
And it does spread from DC, right? Like, you know, Al from SSD coming on here talking about how much he looked up to DC and wanted to do a scene like he thought the DC scene was, how it'd been kind of explained to him. And then, you know, you see that it gets to so it's in Boston, Philadelphia, obviously, New York eventually goes wild with it. Like, it really does seem like this energy that emits from DC at the early 80s. And just as you're saying, like, it's still all over the world today.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. I mean, I think obviously our record's called DC Special, so we're all about our town. But I just want to put it out there that the first touring band on record would be John Philip Sousa's band, which they came out of DC. So they kind of paved the way. They actually went over to Europe too.
That's the thing you brought up earlier with DC.
I think they were like happening like sometime in the 1800s.
That's the thing you brought up about with DC earlier. Going back to the 1800s, there is this, be it go-go, be it the bluegrass stuff, be it this rockabilly scene, be it this new wave scene, be it this punk scene, be it the hardcore, like all
No,
these scenes.
you nailed it because that's one like you. It's hard to explain. I'm not, and someone that's documented all that stuff, but there's one reason why the Bad Brains ended up in New York is because whether or not it's true, it like felt like we had to get out of town to make it, But like I said, DC was a government town, always a huge roots town, which goes back to like fucking olden days of how the music scene started from the people that first settled Washington, DC and the surrounding area. With kind of fiddle music and roots music and DC was one of the I think it had the largest black population prior to the Civil War of free blacks and so which means and they were so they were being creative and be part of the community and making music that was starting to permeate the area and so DC had always been kind of rootsy which is it's still to this day kind of like that. So our punk scene and our new wave scene was kind of a reaction to like kind of do something different to that, But I think DC music definitely has had a huge impact across the whole world and with and like you said go-go which I think is officially like been is like DC music.
Yeah, it's interesting how it is like kind of like you said, a rootsy scene. Like it's like very much, especially with the punk, especially with the hardcore, it's like reality music. And I think that's perfectly illustrated by the fact that I've always been told that the Misfits didn't do well in DC. Like the Misfits thing did great in Detroit, did obviously really great in New York, but in DC, DC was about something
Well, I mean, you
different.
can go back to the Ray brothers, Link Ray, and they had a studio, and I mean, Rumble. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
There
One DC band that I only know from, I think, that Limp Records comp, but they get brought up a couple times on this show as being this sort of legendary band that never got out, was the original Trench Mouth. And I know you guys played with them at least once. What are your
Yeah, I
thoughts on
don't.
Trench Mouth?
Well, I just really I don't
I
remember
didn't.
playing with them, to be honest with you. And I think there were two Trench Mouth, and but yeah, I don't remember that band. I'm sorry. I just know them from that compilation as well.
Okay, I think you played later on with them at a really weird show. I was looking up a list of every single show you guys ever played. As you can tell, you kind of are canonized. So there's a list of every single show you guys ever played with flyers.
I've
I'm
seen
crazy.
that. Where was that you saw that?
It
It's
was all.
online, right?
I'll send you the link. Yeah, I'm going to put the link in the episode too, because it is so awesome going through this list. Obviously, because you guys go everywhere, all over the world, but it will not, well, Europe and all over America and North America, you just get a good picture of how incredible the scene was. And the bands you guys are playing with, you guys did like two shows with the Menstrual Cycles, played with Toxin 3 in Louisiana, like all these bands that exist only in 7-inch form to me.
Right.
I do remember
Well,
seeing that site and
thank God for those bands, because in lots of cases they were probably welcoming us into their town and their little scene, and probably putting on the show for us to play there, So, and that's the community that I was talking about, and that's also the community spirit that we wanted to kind of have in this new record.
Well, and that's the community spirit we have in punk, right? Like that's the fact that it's like we're all weirdly connected, and we all wind up knowing the same people and operating in the same circles. Like a really good friend of mine from England, Robbie Brookside. I believe, Pete, you stayed with him for a couple weeks. The first one of
Whoa, I haven't heard that name in a long time.
a very good friend of the show and a punk rock legend, currently head trainer for the WWE down in Orlando. And
That's
you have
crazy.
to give him my regards, Robbie Brookside. Yeah, I saw him wrestle in London at some little
Oh,
like
he came. I remember that
little
guy
club.
now.
Remember him and
Didn't you?
Granny? Yeah, and he
Yeah,
had
they
a
came
radio
to the
show for
shows.
on LCR, Liverpool City Radio. Yeah. Wow,
Absolutely.
that's a trip.
Yeah, he told me he dragged you to like an AYS or an AOA show, like some crazy crust punk show when you were staying at his house too.
Yeah, he was part of he had his group of friends, they were all pretty diverse.
It's fascinating because he's this guy that I did a documentary series about pro wrestling, so I was kind of like a fan, but in that world a little bit. And his name comes up as sort of this, one of the greatest unsung wrestlers from the UK ever. And then getting to meet
Oh.
him and find out that he's like the downest, deepest punk rock head, and that you stayed at his house
So
even.
weird. I definitely want to hook up with him again. It Florida still is one of those places that you don't go to on tour a lot.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting when you see how the punk scenes develop in these places. And I guess Seattle is the one that everyone famously talks about. When bands don't go to these places, you don't have every band trying to sound like a DC hardcore band at a certain point, which is what Jay and Lou and the Dinosaur Jr. guys said happened for them. Like after a certain point, everybody just wanted to sound like a DC hardcore band. Like it became the brand for a while.
Yeah, well, I mean, and then, but like I was saying before, like when we first were kind of starting out, we wanted to just kind of like mess with their place, just fuck with our people that at the keg parties and shit we were playing at, and just like be different than everybody else, and then we kind of felt we needed to do that within our scene too. So we were kind of always, doing a lot of different styles of music. And sometimes that didn't go over that well. Maybe that's one reason why we're not, as well known as other bands from our town or whatnot, because we never stuck to one formula. We still don't. And, we had Harley join the band in the late 80s, and he looked different than everybody else that was in front of us when we were on stage. And, I'm sure it like bugged some people. We had some metal dude in our band, but we loved Harley's energy and how he looked. And we loved that it kind of rubbed people the wrong way. When Grohl joined the band, he's a completely different drummer than Kent, and put us off in different directions musically as well. So we were musicians and that's what we wanted to do, but we also were conscious that it kind of pushed back on just being like a particular sound.
Well, I think it's because people like simple things, and if a band has one 7-inch, it's very easy to understand, like DC Youth Brigade, very easy to understand. But if you're in a band, and I say this as someone who struggles with trying to grow as you're trying to stay who you are, it's a long life. And the gap between one year to another is immense when you're writing music and being creative. And so, yeah, it's hard for people to see the whole picture, I find. And Scream's a band that took me a long time to see the whole picture with too, to see how the last records relate to the first records and to see that kind of progression and to understand it.
Right. Well, I mean, the early DC bands, they existed through singles, I think. I mean, and Scream existed through full length LPs.
Mm. Yeah, we didn't put our first single out till
a long time.
Yeah,
till Fumble
later on. Yeah, well, Big Walking By Myself single.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up on the very important Jungle Hop Records.
Yeah.
Great label. Put out records from bands from Japan, put out records from obviously American bands all over Europe. Like, another label, Your Choice Live. Absolutely. Sorry.
Yeah, well, that Jungle Hop label, we met this guy, Pierre Pell. He was working at Southern Records in London, kind of like an intern there. And he started that imprint with some friends of his back in Paris, where he's from, and that gave us an opportunity to play in France, which has always been a tough nut to crack if you're a musician, as you know yourself.
Oh yes, still to this day.
But they put out that record, and we ended up playing 9 shows in 1986 just in France, playing in all these small little towns and with a lot of cool bands. It was cool.
Oh, I wonder if you're playing, because it's so fascinating. I just found out the other day that like Phoenix and Air and Daft Punk were all punk bands in France, like around the, late 80s, early 90s. So I wonder if it's like crossing paths with some of those bands back then. 9 shows in France. That's crazy.
We well could have. I just remember a lot of like, it seemed like we were playing with a lot of rockabilly bands in a way, at least the way they were dressed. I don't really remember a lot of the bands that we played with, except how they looked.
Yeah.
It's interesting because like the first punk records come out of France, and there's obviously consistently interesting punk stuff that's coming out of there. But at the same time, you're right. It's fascinating how it's still like the hardest place in Europe to find traction. we can cut this out if you guys can't talk about it, but I know there was a point you guys were going to sign with a Def Jam subsidiary that Glennie Friedman was going to start.
Well, we never got an offer, so I don't know anything. We did sign this thing with Glenn Friedman where he was helping us shop a demo around. But nothing ever came of it. And then after we broke up when Dave joined Nirvana, and after Enoch went back to DC, he's dealing with some issues there, which is basically what ended that kind of run of Scream at the time. Then he came back and kind of like threatened us, which this never sit well with me. And And then and he sued Dave and got money out of him. So real punk rock of Glenn Friedman.
I've never really talked to him since then, though.
Obviously, we have a lot of mutual friends. And yeah, so I mean, you asked me the question. I'm just telling you my perception of it. You know, I know he probably feels like he did us a favor by not suing me and Franz, but we didn't have no fucking money.
Yeah.
So that's just what happened.
It's so, the truth.
Yeah.
I
don't know where this. We were never given any offer for anything. So, and we never signed any offer or anything. This was just like some sort of paper that where he was like shopping our demo around. That's all it was. And then we never got anything out of it. And then nothing ever happened with it. And then, you know, Dave got fortunate and joined Nirvana and become successful. And he took advantage of it.
It's one of the sad things about punk. And like, Ian's never been on the show, but I've talked to him about it privately, where he's just like, that's the thing. If you stick with your network, you're going to be okay. But the reality is, if you want to expand and if you want to do things, you got to reach outside your network and take chances. And then sometimes you run into shitty people doing shitty things.
Yeah. Well, it you know, it's called the music business for a reason.
Yes.
They don't call it music fun.
No, it's not music friends. There's not a lot of friendships after this whole thing's said and done.
But anyway, yeah, so that was then. But hey, you know, that's Ian's right about that. But we were always kind of pushing to do that and get out and get our band out there. And you know, when and Ian always like, you know, encouraged us to do that, because Discord has a certain ethos and a certain, you know, thing that they do, and they do it better than anybody. And we've done multiple records with them. We're back with Discord now, thankfully, you know, that we're still able to be a part of that label and represent. But you know, we did a record with Ross Records, which was also kind of a disappointing record for us, but it's something we had to do as a band to kind of like, you know, move on and move around and do shit, you know?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, because you also, I think even by the second record, you're doing it with like Sixth International and Discord, right? It's like the two labels, or is it just Sixth International just doing the UK pressing?
Well, I don't remember. I don't remember exactly, but yeah, because Discord was, we were like wanting to make more records. Discord could only do so much. And so they incurred, I think we had to reach out to kind of like get the ball rolling. And it's funny about that, because it's kind of the same thing with this, with DC Special. Like when I was bugging Ian about putting out some new record by us, and he would say, well, let's hear what it sounds like. And so he actually, Discord and Ian kind of came on board with DC Special Project after we started recording. They have and that's part of the process with Discord that we've been dealing with since the beginning. So.
But it's like, it's one of those things that like, the system's not broken, why fix it? Vibe. And I can imagine that, you know, as a band, it's hard to deal with that. It's hard to deal with like, what can we do now? Like, it's such a choose your own adventure at every stage with your band, where you're like, do we keep doing what we're doing? Do we try something new? Like, it's a journey.
Yeah.
That's right.
I mean, the Discord's model was to put out a single or an LP from one band and then move on to the next band, and then another band that was coming out of DC or wherever. But we are constantly churning out music, and we wanted to put it out, and it just didn't fall in with the way they did things. So obviously we wanted to reach out and get this stuff put out in whatever way we could.
I think pre-91, American underground music is fascinating because obviously everything changes post Nirvana exploding and people talk about it all the time on here, for better or for worse in some cases. But what were your guys' take on things changing kind of post 83, 84, 85 as you're touring around? Like, are you seeing the rise of metal? Like, or what are you seeing as you're going to other places outside of sort of the, you know, Northeast?
Well, what you said, just like a rise of metal and a lot more kids being involved, you know, with the, you know, through bands like Nirvana, it just becomes a global thing and a little corporate.
Scene was getting bigger, more bands. I wouldn't say as maybe not as much diversity, but you still had, you know, in the punk scene, a lot of diverse bands, but the metal was happening too, which was cool. And, you know, pushing the envelope of sound and rhythm and speed within music. And then as, because the scenes are getting bigger, business comes into play. And so it started getting bigger, you know, and then the major labels started taking more notice of it.
I noticed on this flyer site, not to keep digging into the deepest recesses of your brain, that you played a show on one of the early West Coast tours with Caustic Cause, which is the pre-NoFX band, but also with Justice League, which is Chris Bratton from Wool, first band. Did you meet him at that show, or is that a connection that happens way later?
That happened later. Yeah,
much later.
I think we kind of met Chris through Zach from Rage, I think.
Yeah,
because Zach was in a band with him called Inside Out.
Absolutely. And would you guys have met Zach through Wool when you're living out there in LA, or are you guys playing with Inside Out with Scream?
No, we met him through Wool.
Okay. It's interesting. Wool's like such an awesome super group of people from punk and hardcore too. Like you got Al from the Cheaters and was in the Fastbacks, and you've got, you know, Chris from Justice League.
Concrete Blonde. He was also in Concrete Blonde.
Whoa, that's awesome. That's the credit I didn't know about.
Yeah. I was in Concrete Blonde, but then also don't forget about Pete Moffitt.
Yes, of course, Pete Moffitt, legendary Pete Moffitt too. And it's just like it Wool's a band that I love. I love all those Wool records that you guys did, but it feels like you're just ahead of that kind of like stoner rock thing that explodes a little bit later on in the 90s, Man's Ruin kind of era, and just post whatever came before, and not geographically centered for grunge.
Cool. Well, maybe, yeah, I mean, we're definitely in the mix there.
Yeah. It's a, like records with the Melvins, or Buzz put out a record, obviously, and Bong Load
Yeah, Buzz put our first single out, actually.
Well, it's interesting how like the Melvins also wind up in Los Angeles. It seems like Los Angeles was like the place you had to go if you're going to be a working band prior to the 90s happening. Like, you know, all these hardcore bands, the post-hardcore bands, most of them wind up there.
Or New York. Or New York, the same, you know, I'm sure the Bad Brains felt the same way. They had to go to New York just because D.C. was so small. Not only inside, but just in the places you could play. And New York is obviously bigger with more clubs and just more of a happening going on.
Like, you know, like going back to what we earlier in this conversation with Henry going out there with the Teen Idols, you know, and then he ends up back out there with Black Flag. But yeah, the shows in LA were always huge, not even good grammar, but
I got what you're saying. I know
there are bigger shows, bigger scene, bigger landscape, you know.
And maybe Buzz just got sick of the rain, that's why they moved out.
I think also it's interesting though, because like New York, you're right, a lot of people wind up in.
Surprised the Melvins just didn't end up moving down to Tijuana, because they basically came from Seattle down to San Francisco and then into LA. So.
If they hadn't stopped, if they hadn't found a fertile ground in Los Angeles, maybe they would have kept rolling. Maybe they'd be in Brazil by now.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Let's just say the Melvins are one of the greatest bands ever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think you know, yourselves and the Melvins, you know, like, you have to talk about this bullshit all the time, so I apologize for this, but I think it is such a huge thing for punk music when the Nirvana thing happens. And I'm walking through the mall with my kid, and every single store has like some weird Nirvana t-shirt in it. Every third person's got a Nirvana shirt on, you know, like there's such a seismic shift that happens with Nirvana, but it's Scream and the Melvins that are the foundations of this thing that eventually happens. Like the Melvins put them together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, Nirvana's a great band, especially, and you know, Dave really took them up a notch too. They were already a cool band, but Dave, you know, his energy and his talents, you know, really made them really exceptional and hugely influential and important band. It's too bad that they flamed out like that, because who knows, you know, what more we would have been able to hear from them, you know. But you know, definitely it helped, like, you know, Wool was our, we were, you know, it didn't take long for me and my brother to like get a new band together. It's what we do. And so we had Wool, you know, going when, you know, Nirvana came down and recorded Nevermind, you know, and then we played together at the Roxy and maybe at Jabberjaw, which was like this cool coffee shop in LA that kind of the early, that scene kind of came out of.
You seen that book that Brian Ray Turcotte did? Like the fantastic.
No, I have.
You're in it. There's Wool photos in it, and it's, cool. It's fantastic. Nice. Cause you're right. That's undersung kind of scene, that kind of like bridge era.
Yeah. Cause I mean, that's where I met, you know, Courtney was that was when she started Hole there. I met her through, through the L7.
The L7 girls.
Yeah, I met them there, and you know, I work with L7 now, kind of as you know, on their tours and stuff, and we're still family.
An amazing band, and a band that, like, you know, it was around in Los Angeles during those lean years when they were on the show. Like they've talked about how, like, that was it was pretty bleak in LA after punk kind of gets washed away by hardcore, and then hardcore just kind of implodes.
Uh-huh.
Were you a fan of Bleach? Cause it's interesting when Nate from the Foo Fighters was on and a bunch of people have been on, and they were like, yeah, I wasn't that fan of Bleach at the time. Like, it seems like a record that people loved or weren't as into. And it feels like that was like Brian Walsby, when he was on the show, talked about how he turned down being in Nirvana when Dale Crover asked him to be the drummer because he didn't like Bleach.
That's crazy. I thought it was a cool record. Dave was into it. I wasn't really conscious. I mean, I was definitely conscious of Nirvana. They were when we were where the fuck? I remember being on tour with them in Europe, but honestly, I can't remember if it was Scream or Wool. I think those are different bands, but we're still kind of moving on our journey as musicians. And so it's another outfit, you know, put on some fancier clothes.
It must've been though different touring in Europe with Scream than Wool, right? Because I think, you know, from Wool, what you're saying, like you're playing squat venues. I guess some of those later tours must have been a little bit more comfortable than those.
Well, that's definitely where we came from. And so what we were still, and, you know, we like playing those kind of venues. It's where it feels home for us. And so when we can, we do. And, you know, even as even like the last was shit. We haven't actually, we just went to Europe this past summer, which was great, and the summer before, but we played mostly festivals. But our last proper tour in Europe was in 2011, I think. And yeah. We played some of the squats that are still around, like the Porta Presentino, which is in Rome, and one in Bologna. So, but yeah, I guess when we were with Wool, we were on a major label. So we were like playing more established venues, and you know, we We went over there with Rage Against the Machine on our first tour in England, so, and Tool.
Well, that's a wild first tour.
Yeah, it was cool.
It's crazy.
I think Tool was headlining. I can't fucking remember. It was Wool, Tool, and Rage on the same bill. Yeah, we did like a bunch of shows in England. It was great.
We played with L7 over there as well.
Yeah.
And in Europe, in Germany and whatnot, even weirder is that we were opening up for Faith No More.
Yeah, that's true.
What would that have been, around 92, 93?
Something like that.
Yeah.
I find it fascinating. 94. I find it fascinating in Europe how it is like this tradition that gets passed down. Like you still play squats that have been around since they were established in some places. And there's sort of this, like, it is this sort of cultural thing that does wind up getting passed down more in Europe, I find, than here, but you do see it here now, like second generation, third generation punks, like that band Linda Linda's, like both of their parents, sets of their parents were punks and stuff. So you do have this sort of, it continues thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's some of that going on in DC right now. And Brennan Canty's daughter fronting has a new band called Birthday Girl that I haven't seen them yet, but you hear the buzz of the new bands at home, from home, and that's one of them. Yeah, it's cool. But, you know, I think unfortunately in this country, our government doesn't support the arts, or they don't really support youth. They don't, we, you know, can't even get kids fed at school. Yeah. But yeah, so a lot of these squats and some of these great little places that were created by punkers and artists got, you know, ultimately got turned into venues that were, you know, they were and are now like maybe for profit places, but it still, some of the core kind of ideas about why that space is there still kind of drive their programs.
Well, and that's why, you know, I love thinking about that sort of stuff and the idea that this can carry on and this can still exist, because it makes it more than music. It was more than just, why do the Jam fit in with Minor Threat when they don't sound anything like, and why are we all somehow part of this? But it is the sort of greater cultural thing that, the more I talk to people, it's comparable to religion, and the way you have guilt when you leave a religion that stays with you, like people that broke straight edge in their 20s that are still upset about it in their 40s, or still have feelings about it in their 40s. Like, this is deeper than just picking up a record at a store and listening to it for a couple of years.
Yeah. And that's why we wanted to make, one reason why we wanted to make this record was to kind of, you know, celebrate our past and our history through DC music history, and create a thread that we carry forward into now and at what we're doing now, you know, and I think we achieved that with this record by by having our community participate in it and collaborate with us on it.
So both of you guys have found ways to be lifers in this thing. Was there ever a point where you're like, I just got to get a straight job and leave this world behind and be a normal? Like, was there ever a moment like that?
A brief moment when the only time that we felt like we could continue was when we were in Wool, because we had a little money from the label and stuff. But, you know, everything else, we always have jobs. I have a job to this day, and so does Pete. I mean, music is what we do, and we are going to continue to do it as long as we can. But we always had to have a job to buffer that existence. I mean,
yeah.
I never felt like cutting out. You know, there may be regrets later, like I should have went to college or finished school or whatever, but we've always had jobs, and we were under no illusion that there was any other way around it. I mean, you have to pay bills and rent and all that stuff. So,
yeah. And you know, and I've been doing a lot of tour management, because I kind of just fell into that kind of line of work out of being the guy that, you know, booked the shows or, you know, collected the money at the end of the night. And so then people started asking me to do that for them. So, which, you know, ended up ultimately paying more than being a musician. So it's actually, which also kind of handicapped me of being pursuing music more full time. It's, And that's always the catch 22. And that's just the way that everybody has to deal with that in life. And you know what, when Kent left the band the first time, he wanted to raise a family. And you have to present it with those kind of things in life where you have to decide what you're going to do. And so I guess we've tried to get the best of both worlds by continuing to play music and you know, and then also having to like try to make a living and survive. You know?
I didn't mean to say like, you know, not having another job necessarily, but this is your career. Like music has always been your careers. And there's like, it's almost like this type of person that's like a lifer. And then there's a type of person, which this is like a high school football thing that you look back upon. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was a brief period in your life. Even Kent, like Kent kept doing bands. Like he did other bands in DC, right, in the 90s and stuff. So it's not like,
Kent had a, you know, was playing in a trio called the Old Dominion Trio, just like a couple weeks before he passed away.
He was so good.
Yeah, I mean, he would be, you know, playing every weekend with somebody. So yeah, you're right. He was a lifer that way.
Yeah, it's something that stays with us. I find that like fascinating that there's like, I don't know. And maybe because I was not part of another culture, but I can imagine like there are other things that you would have been involved in that don't wind up people bringing up to you 40 years later, talking about records you played on as a teenager, you know, like,
oh, and by the way, congratulations on your upcoming tour with the Damned.
Oh my God. That's tell me fucking about that.
That is crazy.
That is crazy to me. Cause like, you know, if it's like a Beatles and Rolling Stones thing, I've always been more of a Who person. And in a Clash Sex Pistols thing, I've always been more of a Damned person. So
that's where we come from.
You probably heard that before. The Damned, they have a special place in the DC punk lore and community that, you know, they definitely big influence on us. And we actually, I don't think that these flyers are on, you know, archived anywhere, but we opened up for the Damned for two nights at the 9:30 Club once.
Whoa.
Real highlight for us. I don't know. I guess you might find it on a 9:30 Club flyer or something, but yeah.
That's awesome. And it's, yeah, they're just like, well, that's the thing about DC that I also find so awesome is
I wanted to quickly say that we tried to get Captain Sensible to produce one of our records. Franz called him up and spoke with him on the phone, actually, back then.
Yeah.
Because well, Rat Scabies also produced a bunch of stuff back then, too, right? Like, didn't he do some key? I'm trying to remember what America. He did a big American record back then, but I love the cast.
He did?
Yeah, I love the Captain's production, though, on all those Dolly Mixtures records.
Mm.
That stuff's awesome. Awesome. It's, I think that's the thing about DC is because it's sort of like the first, in a lot of ways, the first real hardcore scene that, you know, starts where it's like the kind of model that we all follow. And because you're saying it's very insular looking, it was the first scene that really seemed to study punk and find these obscure records. I remember Ian played me this recording of the first time HR ever sang for the Bad Brains. And they cover the Vile Tones' Screaming Fist, which is an obscure record in Toronto where it came out, let alone it showing up in DC, or the way the Empire record just completely changed the sound of bands when people discovered the Empire record. I find it so interesting how studied everyone is.
Yeah, well, I guess we could thank our you know, local record stores, the mom and pops like that were in DC at the time, like Yesterday and Today and Joe's Record Paradise and Penguin Feather. There was all these really, I mean, important record stores where that featured new music, and those radio shows I was telling you about, because that's one thing kind of unique about DC. Maybe you know, there, because of the universities there, American University and Georgetown University and Maryland University, they had like cool radio shows that featured new music. Even if it was only for 1 hour once a week, you know, but then we would tune in, you know.
Go ahead. You'd also get the odd cassette from friends and stuff. But, whoa, what the fuck is this on here? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's amazing how these reverberations of that, these radio stations, these record stores have, like Jennifer from Royal Trucks talking about being a DC hardcore kid getting into Discharge, you know, or John Spencer being out of DC when Pussy Galore first starts. Like, there's a lot of stuff that's not necessarily under the umbrella that's coming out of this sort of influence.
Yeah, and Dave Grohl worked at Tower Records in DC too, so I'm sure.
There you go.
He was getting off, learning about music. That was before he was in our band, or I don't know, maybe he was working there when he was in our band. I can't remember, but.
Did you guys ever play with Dane Bramage?
No, but I saw them play.
I saw
Dave play. I really like that band.
I love that album so much. Yeah. Another example of just sort of like the shit that was all happening in that area. Cause like also, you know, it's DC, but then it's also Maryland area and Virginia too. You know, like I noticed at one point you play a show with Scam and United Mutations and Media Disease.
Yeah. Somebody just re-released that Scam record or re-released something with Scam recently. I was supposed to get a copy of it from Enoch. He's got one. But speaking of that, that time in that like venue, that DC Space is where I saw Dane Bramage. And this would be a perfect example of roots music combining with punk would be like we backed up Root Boy Slim at DC Space one time. And it was part of a benefit to raise money for the I think it was to raise money to help Alternative Tentacles fight the court case against the Dead Kennedys record cover. And we ended up doing, we play, and that was really rad. I don't know if you're familiar with Root Boy Slim.
Yeah, that's amazing. I had no idea about that show.
Yeah, I got to be a backup singer in his band. We did Boogie Till You Puke.
I guess that also speaks to why the big boys connected with DC so much, because there is that sort of
because Biscuit was as big as Root Boy.
No, not necessarily just that, but I mean stylistically there's sort of like reaching outside of the capital P punk world.
Yeah, man, the big boys are so cool. They first time we went through, we played with them in Austin at Nightbreak, I think it was. No, that was in San Francisco, I think it was a club named after that Bob Seger song, Night Moves. It's something like that. But they were so cool. They, you know, and that's what we were talking about earlier with the, you know, the bands that would put on shows for you. Well, big boys were already kind of big. It felt like to me, but, you know, they had us on, we played, opened up for them, and then they had us over their house, had a barbecue. And I think we might have, you know, some of us might have slept over that house that they all had. And, you know, it was really cool people.
And a really deep connection, too, with, well, obviously there's a famous division with some DC, with one DC band, but with everything else, like there feels like a really strong big boy, specifically Texas connection. And there's that famous Trouble Funk, Minor Threat, Big Boy show that, you know, you see the flyer for all the time. Like there is this sort of, I don't know.
It came out of that sharing community of you come stay here, and then when we're near town, we'll stay there, you know, and we'll put you up and we'll feed you and you got a place to stay and you're all good, you know. So,
and that's the amazing thing that you kind of retained from it too, like you can still reach out to these people all these years later. Like I guarantee you, if you need a place to crash in the Orlando area, Robbie will put you up to this day.
Well, you know, the other thing is that what people don't talk about, one of the reasons why there was that connection that you didn't necessarily find in Los Angeles, because most of these kids involved in the scenes lived at home with their parents. And the scenes in like in DC or Texas, a lot of those people were already living out of their house in houses with other people. And that's something that I found when we went out to LA. There wasn't a lot of people living on their own, it seemed like. Just a little side note as far as the scene.
Los Angeles is interesting because it seems like, even from what you guys are saying, like all the different people you're interacting, there's a lot of musical mobility in Los Angeles that might not exist in New York. Like you don't really hear about the reaching over the lines in sort of the same way. Like everyone seems to be more in their own little scenes in New York at this point, especially.
We did a similar thing in LA when we arrived there, is like we'd always done in a home, was have a band house. And then that was kind of became ground zero for all our activities, you know, and it might also become a hangout. And then, you know, started to make our own little scene, you know. And I don't know. That's just kind of how it happened for us there. But when we first ended in Los Angeles, before we got Wolf going, it didn't feel very, very friendly place to me. And I was having a hard time figuring out where, you know, if I even wanted to stay there. Felt like I kind of want. I think we felt more in line with the Bay Area than we did in LA, but we started working and started making stuff happen for ourselves. And especially once I met a few people that brought me out to the desert where I'm at right now. And then started playing music at the Rancho. Then that really kind of, I fell in love with Los Angeles and California.
How far is that sort of desert scene from like Los Angeles proper, like by car, like an
2 hours, 10 minutes.
Wow. And it's like a completely different world though, right?
Well, it was in the 90s when I first started coming out here, but you know, people used to make fun of me about trying to get people to come out to the studio. And back then nobody really came out here, but now this area is just like, I don't know, you know, think that Coachella had a huge impact on this area, bringing like 80,000 people from around the world every year. And then, you know, also just LA getting too expensive, people started moving out here. So it's changed a lot. But when I first started coming out here, it you know, people didn't so much venture out here so much.
Was it through the band house that you meet Greg Anderson? Is it, or did you know him before that?
No, Franz and I met Greg up in Seattle when with Wool, and we played with his band Engine Kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's amazing to see how like that scene, like Sun, Queens of the Stone Age, you know, like there's like a lot of important heavy music comes out of that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, I think I kind of like, you know, I was telling Greg about LA, and I think, you know, so us talking, he got interested in moving down there. You know, Goatsnake came much later, but yeah, through you brought up Man's Ruin earlier. Through Wool, and I was playing in you know, the community out of Rancho, that's how we kind of met. Josh and the Caius guys, and start playing shows together.
It seems like that would have been light years away from that DC scene that you guys originally come out of, in terms of like, you know, party vibe.
I personally don't feel that, but I feel like that's part of the thread that I'm talking about, because like, you know, Goatsnake basically came out of the Obsessed, and Scream used to play with the Obsessed back in DC. So they were one of the first bands we kind of aligned with, because they were a little bit different. We used to play shows together, and it was a different lineup. But there's, you know, Wino was the center point for that. But you know, frankly, one of the first singers for the Obsessed was Vance Bacchus, rest in peace, who went to school with Franz and Enoch, and from Bailey's Crossroads. So we're all really tied together.
Because I don't think you guys ever identified as a straight edge band, but was that something that followed you around in the early years? Because it's crazy how fast that catches
on.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
You're asked that everywhere you go and in every interview you do.
Yeah. It wasn't until Dave Grohl got famous that people stopped asking us about straight edge.
I'm bringing up all the cliched questions on this thing. This thing with the straight edge thing I find is that it's almost transcendent punk at this point, like because of that wrestler CM Punk and Avril Lavigne and all these celebrity people talking about straight edge and claiming straight edge that don't necessarily have They do, but not necessarily people taking it in have any connection to where it comes from, but it has become, oh, it's just, it's ubiquitous at this point.
Right. Well, I mean, we were part of that scene and we were always, you know, we were just kind of, for us, it was a little bit different. It was more about PMA and positive mental attitude and, you know, and doing, being a part of your community and activism and this side up, you know?
Mm-hmm. And very much like that, once again, that you guys are halfway between that sort of Bad Brains philosophical approach and the sort of DC hardcore philosophical approach.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why this band is one of my favorite bands to talk about. I really do. Like, I'm fascinated by your band, and the study of your band is something that I've been interested in since I first got into this music, and which is after the fact, obviously, but it's just, it's just mind blowing the way you guys connect all these worlds and just sort of like move throughout the history of this music after a certain point as these sort of agents of amazing music, but also agents of change.
Thank you, man. We appreciate that.
That means a lot.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate you having us on your show so we could, you know, talk about our music and our bands and also, you know, we want people to check out our new record and you know, so thank you for that.
I think it's awesome that, you know, yourselves, Soulside, Hammered Hulls, and I know I'm leaving someone else right now. Fuck.
Well, Bedmaker.
Yeah. And what's the post, the new Minor Threat thing that they did, that Mesthetics?
Mesthetics.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
With Joe Lowe. Yeah.
I feel like there's like a,
they're getting ready to, they have a new record that they're working on that's been done, but they ran into some bullshit kind of business stuff to in order to get it. You know, they've been collaborating with a saxophonist, and I think they had some trouble working through the business red tape of being able to release the record. I hope they got that worked out. But yeah, they have a new record coming out.
It's awesome that all you guys are still in it. You know, like there's a sort of return to DC, like all you guys spread out and did your own things, but there's sort of this homecoming thing that's happening right now, and everyone's putting out fucking amazing records. It's not like bullshit nostalgia.
No, in fact, Amanda texted me this morning because when I was there, when did I see her? Oh, I guess after we did that.
The show in the park.
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, we're talking about maybe trying to go down to play together at South by Southwest. So maybe we can make that happen. It's, you know, it's hard. It's hard with everybody, with their jobs and families and all that, to, you know, at our level of, you know, it's hard to pay the bills and to go on a little tour like that, but that's what we'll try to do.
That'd be amazing. Or like a little Madam's Organ, reopen Madam's Organ and do a show all together there.
I was just standing outside of Madam's Organ not too long ago. It's crazy. Cause we're just so fucking lucky that we're still a band and able to put out new music and play shows. And me and Enoch were walking up 18th Street, and we I was trying to figure out which building was Madam's Organ. And there's two kind of like row houses. They're both businesses now. But and then we walked up the street a little bit more to get something to eat. Me and Enoch just did this show for the Mayor's Art Awards, which I don't know how that came about, but after we played 2 weeks ago at the MLK Library, which was a great honor, and as part of the punk archive, go-go archive that they got there at that library, which I highly recommend anyone that goes visits Washington, go to the Martin Luther King Library. It's an amazing, amazing space. Not just, you know, the archives there for music, but just the local history. And they do a lot of cool stuff for the community, including putting on these shows. And we just played with Trouble Funk for the first time, even though we had done other punk go-go shows before. Finally got to play with them, which was a real honor. And then there were some new bands that we weren't familiar. And whoever curated that show did an amazing job playing with this band called Black Alley, which is a really cool band, a go-go band doing kind of a new thing. A band called Breezy Supreme was kind of really cool. It's almost like emo punk band, but you know, a mixed ethnicity band. And then Bachnai, which was a cool punk band, some girls in it. So that was killer. The DC scene is happening. It's alive right now.
Oh, yeah. Like arguably the biggest hardcore band in the world right now, a current band.
Turnstile.
You know, and there's all that kind of all the bands that are from that sort of greater universe, which does connect back to like, you know, Trapped Under Ice. I forget the guitar player's father was in, I'm blanking on which DC band now, but it was in like an old Discord band. So there's like this sort of like continuation, but like it's still DC that's putting the stuff on the map.
Yeah, driving it forward.
It's wild. It's very, it's interesting because it's like,
keep it in gear.
Well, there's such an industry to keep it going too, right? Like there's like this DC hardcore industry, but then at the same time, it's like you can't deny the music. The music's what ultimately keeps connecting with people.
Mm-hmm.
What, yeah. Before I let you guys go, I've always wondered what your thoughts were when that Revolution Summer moment happens. You guys are kind of on the road, I think, by that point and kind of in other places, but did you like, was it getting too hairy in DC in your eyes? Was it definitely at the point where something had to change or, you know, just what were your takeaways from that time?
What do you mean? What do you mean by hairy? I mean, yeah. That was that DC was going through a very difficult time at that around then with the inner city crime and we were, you know, but I think that those bands that came out of that summer, you know, that's kind of a new explosion of DC music that happened. It's the way the way it's supposed to be, you know, these kids coming up and making their own thing happen.
The way that it's like, I mean, just sort of in the sense that like hairy, because the way it's always talked about, I think once again, it's in Dance of Days. I can't remember the specific skinhead woman's name, but there's a woman who apparently had this skinhead gang that was fucking up kids at the shows. And it's a notorious time for just sort of violence at the shows. Like the stuff had gone too far. And there were a lot of people that just, you know, once again, like same thing that happened with the limp scene, I guess, same thing that happened with the LA punk scene, just kind of were like,
the skinhead scene in DC was very, very small. I mean, you could literally almost count them on your hand.
Doesn't mean they can't cause problems at shows. So
no, of course.
I think that's part of being, you know, that's part of being part of a art and music community is looking out for each other. So I think it, you know, a reaction to that would be to speak about it and to sing about it and to maybe, you know, try to like, you know, take care of each other that way. So maybe that's what that was.
Well, anytime you guys want to come back on the show separately or together and talk about LA, DC, Robbie Brookside, anything, you know, the door's always open.
Yeah, you gotta hook me up with Robbie. And, you know, we used to, one of my favorite shows, thinking about wrestling, was when we played at the Madison Square Garden in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm sure you know about that venue, right?
I know it from the cover of This Is Phoenix, Not LA compilation.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a single too that JFA had called Mad Garden, because it was also kind of referred to it as that. But that place was fucking rad. And I don't know who we played with there, unfortunately, but we played there, and I'll never forget, like, you know, it was just so cool setting up the gear on inside the ring, you know, and the place was still, it had a wrestling ring in the center of the venue and bleachers against the wall and these giant pictures all around the venue of, you know, Haystack Calhoun and all these like fucking famous wrestlers from back in the day. And it also had a fence around the fucking ring that went. And so
it's called a steel cage.
Yeah. Well, I guess, but I don't think it wasn't because it wasn't for like what you have now with the cage fighting and MMA and stuff like that. It was mostly, I think, to keep the crowd from throwing shit at the wrestlers, probably. I don't know. or maybe to keep them from, I think the fence was there because somebody threw someone out of the ring and it maybe hurt somebody. But when we started that set, like, there was like kids all around the thing. And I remember we came out there and I picked up the mic stand and just threw it as hard as I can right at the fucking crowd, you know, and everyone's like, fucking jump back. But it was so fucking fun, man. And everyone was like fucking climbing up on the fucking chain link fence and, you know, stage diving from the fence.
Oh yeah. What an amazing scene too. Phoenix had Sun City Girls, JFA, Mighty Sphincter, Feeders, like, oh,
yeah.
Such a cool place. Oh my gosh. Well,
yeah. And also at that time, there was also a cool scene in Tucson, like bands like MIA. And there was a good club there called the Backstage, I think, that we used to play.
It's interesting with wrestling how there is such a strong current throughout punk too. And I think it's because wrestling subverts sports in the same way punk subverts rock and roll and just sort of turns it on its heads and plays with the conventions. And it's just, I don't know, but you do see, like, be it Bob Mould or the guys in the Stretch Marks doing that punk fanzine back in the day, to Robbie Brookside, to like Breezy Supreme. And I have a mutual friend in MVP who's a pro wrestler that saved the Misfits from being murdered by the Macho Man Randy Savage back in the day. So there's a real strong connection between these two worlds.
That's crazy. Yeah. Well, we didn't have that in DC.
Let's not forget Captain Lou Albano, who fucking managed NRBQ, which was a huge band in the DC area when I was growing up.
Absolutely.
See them all the time.
And Greg Sage played on Beauregard's LP, a pro wrestler's LP, when he was 15 years old before the Wipers. So we have a common shared history. Well, thank you for sharing your history with me.
We actually come from a wrestling family. My sister was a mud wrestler here in Los Angeles at the Tropicana.
Whoa, that's awesome. Well, that's part two. We already got the jumping off point for episode two.
Yeah.
Franz and Pete, thanks for coming on the show. And you're right there. They will be back for a part two, together or separate, at some point in the near future, because there is a lot more to get to. I could have talked to them for all day, but there is a lot of podcasts to get to. Speaking of getting to a podcast, how do you follow up having one of the greatest sibling punk rock duos ever by having one of the greatest sibling trios in hardcore? The Russin brothers are coming on the show next. That's right. From Cold World, we got Alex. From Glitterer and Title Fight, we got Ned. And from Citizen and Title Fight, we got Ben. And we got all three coming up on the next episode. And it is an epic episode. Took a year to record. Like a year to the day it took to record this thing. And it spans continents and journey. You'll hear it all on the next episode. But that is it for me. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights. And cut out hate and violence towards people of different faiths, different races, because we're not talking about politics here. We're talking about human rights. People deserve to live free from hate and violence and war. So if there's organizations around you that are affecting positive change, get involved, donate your time, donate your money, and maybe you'll feel better. Speaking of feeling better, if you want to feel better, try meditating. I know a lot of people say that this stuff has worked for them. And add me to that choir, because it works for me. And maybe it'll work for you. And so there's lots of ways to try it. Stick with it, because, like, if you're like me, it took a while for it to click, but when it does click, it will help. Speaking of helping, sign those organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them anymore, and it can perform miracles. I've seen that happen. Seen it happen with my own eyes. Organ donor transplant stuff.
just bringing new life to people. So sign those cards and contribute to your punk scene. Start a band, start a fanzine, start a podcast. Start something. Anyone can do this stuff and you'll feel better, and it gets better when you contribute to it. Well, that's it for me. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I'll see you on the next, or I won't. I'll speak to you on the next episode. Bye.